All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I can't calm down when I hear this song. Teddy, turn it up just a little bit more and a little bit longer so we can hear just a little bit more. All right, that put me in the mood. That put me right where I need to be for the show. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. We got a packed show today. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Gregory Koger, former prisoner and activist who's facing 300 days in jail for simply video recording a statement against censorship out in Chicago at the Ethical Human Society. I'll tell you what, doesn't seem like it's very ethical what's going on there. And we'll be talking with Gregory about that at the back end of the show. Before that, we'll be talking with Dr. Terry Coopers, psychiatrist and expert on the psychological effects of prison conditions. And we'll be talking about a dramatic increase in suicides related to solitary confinement. So stay tuned for that one. And opening the show up, I'm really pleased to welcome back to the show Alan Goodman. Alan's a reporter for Revolution Newspaper, and we're going to be talking with Alan about Israel's murderous assault on the people of Gaza and the need to oppose these crimes now. We're going to talk about the nature and role of Israel, the part that the U.S. and Obama played in these crimes, and the need for resistance everywhere. So it's going to be a packed show, and let's jump into it now. Alan, welcome to the show.
Good to be here, Michael.
Well, good, man. Good to hear you. Let's jump into this, this monstrous assault that's been going on Gaza, against Gaza by the Israeli government, by Israel, and backed by the U.S. Let's get an update on where things stand now. A lot has happened over the last couple of weeks. Let's talk about where things stand now.
Two things are difficult to make an assessment of. One is exactly the nature and status of the ceasefire and how fragile it is. The one thing we can say is that nothing fundamentally has been settled, and there is no fundamental justice for the Palestinian people in Gaza who continue on a daily basis to live in what's accurately been called the world's largest outdoor prison. So neither of those things have changed. One thing is, I wrote my article for Revolution Newspaper, available at revcom.us, early in Israel's assault, and at that time, the death toll was under 50, I think. The reliable numbers we're seeing now are between 130 and 150 people. But I think it's important to humanize the victims of this assault. You know, one thing that Israel just goes on and on about is how one of the things that distinguishes them, when I see these Israeli spokespeople on TV or the defenders of Zionism, and they say, well, we're the only country that issues warnings before we, wipe out an apartment building or shell a hospital or whatever. And I just wanted to share this with your readers from the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, which ran an article a couple days ago, the title of which was Gaza's 96 Dead Include Farmers, Water Sellers, and the Girl Next Door. And, of course, that number's grown quite a bit since that article was run. But just briefly from that Haaretz article, on this whole thing, warnings, it says, Israeli Air Force warnings of an impending attack do not always give Gaza residents enough time to get away. At about 2 a.m. yesterday, the Israeli Air Force fired warning rockets at an empty home in the Zaytun neighborhood. The building exploded about a minute later, trapping members of the neighboring Abu Zur family inside their home, killing a 5-year-old boy along with 2 men and a woman. 28 family members were injured in the attack. 20 homes were partially damaged. And that article goes on to document, farmers on their way to market with a truck with tomato crates was hit by an Israeli missile, the 3 occupants killed. A water vendor who sells bottled water. 95% of the people in Gaza have to rely on bottled water just as a result of the conditions of the Israeli blockade. A water vendor and his 10-year-old son were distributing or selling purified water when they were hit by an Israeli missile. So I just think it's important, as we'll get into what's behind all this, to really, get some sense of what we're talking about here in terms of human life.
You know, it is. I think it is important. I agree. I think, and it's horrendous when you actually investigate what's going on here. And you know, one of the things I was looking at in terms of the media coverage, there's been just a slew of things that, you know, if they show something from the people in Gaza and what they're suffering under, then they have shown, at least out, you know, the LA Times, a few other papers that I've seen have bent over backwards to present sort of, well, it's sort of an equal situation. And they'll show Israelis like getting out of their vans and hiding behind the van and rockets coming in. And, you know, they never really, they always make it appear to be this sort of equal thing. They're both to blame. They're both suffering. It's equal suffering. And it's really, it calls into question, I mean, one, the fact that the nature of the media coverage, and also the question of complicity in particular with a lot of the media in the U.S.
Well, I think that's true, but you know we've got a short show, so let's in a short segment. So let's get to the heart of things. I think, you know, underlying a lot of this, and this paralyzes even a lot of good people. And you know, for example, take our friends at Democracy Now. I've been watching Amy Goodman's coverage of the situation. She had a defender of Zionism on a couple nights ago. And she continually, you know, challenged him, correctly so, on the incredible disproportionality of deaths. I mean, Israel is reporting 5 deaths, but nothing, any, you know, even in the ballpark of the kind of widespread terror, death, and suffering that's been inflicted on the Palestinian people. But the, you know, the defender of Zionism kept coming back to, well, look, you know, Israel has a right to defend itself. And until we deconstruct, demystify, and refute the whole underlying premise behind this, you know, good people are going to be way too paralyzed. I mean, there's two salient facts that people need to understand. One is Israel was and is literally built on the blood, bones, land, and homes of Palestinian people stolen through terrorist ethnic cleansing. That's, you know, to talk about Israel's right to defend itself is no more, you know, no more corresponds to the actual terms of things than if someone went into your house, you know, drove you out, shot up the house, killed a couple of your family members, and, you know, sprayed machine gun fire around the place, and as you were running out, yelled, you know, I do have a right to defend myself, don't I? I mean, this is what happened. This stuff's documented. I really want to encourage your listeners to go to revcom.us/Israel for a special issue of Revolution on Israel that documents this in a lot of detail, drawing on Zionist sources in many cases. So that's one thing. And the second thing is that Israel's role in the world is as an enforcer of capitalism and imperialism. I mean, what does Israel supporting the apartheid regime in South Africa, or, you know, playing a key role in the massacre of 200,000 indigenous Guatemalan peasants in the 1980s have to do with, you know, defending yourself? So these two facts, and yes, we are going up against, you know, an enforced narrative. It's not just the LA Times that's got that perspective. CNN and the, you know, and unfortunately, again, too many people who are correctly appalled by what Israel's doing to the Palestinians. We all need to get out of that framework that, you know, the media and Obama and all of them are imposing on us, that no one can question Israel's quote unquote right to defend itself.
Well, first, let me remind listeners that you tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Alan Goodman from Revolution Newspaper, and we're talking about the Israeli assault on Gaza and the people and the Palestinian people. Now, Alan, one of the things, as you're saying that, one of the things that always comes up invariably, and we can speak to this quickly because I do know we have to move through a lot of material here now, but the idea always comes up, how dare you even talk about questioning what Israel does in the world in order to save itself, because after all, there was the Holocaust.
Right. Well, that is, you know, that is kind of an essential question. The Holocaust was one of the great crimes of modern history, but on a very basic moral level, how does that justify, you know, how does a crime committed against the Jewish people by the German regime, which was a horrific crime, how does that justify the dispossession, exile, humiliation, oppression, and denial of self-determination of the Palestinian people? It doesn't. And there's actually, an important lesson, as long as I'm on your show here, just for oppressed people and people struggling for justice to learn from, a heavy lesson, which is, are you going to take something, and like this and say, well, what I'm taking from that is, no matter what I have to do to anybody else, I'm going to make sure that doesn't happen to my people. Or are you going to take it as, never again shall it be allowed that crimes against humanity go on, and people plead ignorance or impotence as an excuse for not doing anything to stop those crimes? And these are two, profoundly different moral ways to look at the relationship between the Holocaust and the State of Israel, and they lead to two very different worlds.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about what you raised earlier, Israel's role in the world, enforcing the global system of capitalism and imperialism. And in particular, let's look at the U.S. response to what's been going on in the Israeli attack on Gaza. And it was really interesting. I read the New York Times this morning, and one of the things that they were saying there was that they were pointing out a lot of the close communications between the Israeli ambassador to the U.S. and the U.S. government. And then they were talking about, that the U.S. had a joint military exercise with Israel just 3 weeks ago, in which, these kinds of scenarios were actually being prepared for.
Well, this is one of the more strategic relationships that the United States has in the world. And there's a lot of mythology around this. A lot of people make, particularly on the left, or, people who have some sense of the injustice being done to the Palestinians, see this as a matter of, the Israeli lobby, or even sometimes it's put the Jewish lobby, corrupting the U.S. or, interfering with the interests of the U.S. imperialists, or as they would put it, our country, but I wouldn't put it that way, in the region. And it is true that the U.S. quote-unquote special relationship with Israel does, create some very awkward moments when you are trying, for example, to shake the new regime in Egypt into something that serves the needs of U.S. imperialism in a country and in a region where the masses of people have tremendous, sympathy and feel a lot of solidarity with the Palestinians. So, a formulation that we've used in revolution is that the U.S. is stuck with and sticking by Israel, which is to say that even while the U.S. relationship with Israel presents a lot of challenges in kind of reshaping the Middle East and the Arab world in a way that they're trying to do, there's nothing like Israel. And, the examples I gave of carrying out major operations on behalf of the U.S. in South Africa and Guatemala in the 80s and today. We, in our special issue of Revolution, we documented how Israel's role in the assassination of a leader of the People's War in India. So this is when there's dirty work to be done, often the U.S. turns to Israel, both in the region and worldwide, and there's no country that does what Israel does for U.S. imperialism.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Alan Goodman, writer for Revolution Newspaper, and we're talking about the Israeli attack on Gaza. And Alan has a very, very, very important and provocative article on Israel's murderous assault on the people of Gaza and the need to oppose these crimes now, and you can find that at revcom.us. Now, Alan, one of the things in relation to this, central to your analysis of the whole situation there, you talk about this, the context for what's going on in the region is the rapidly changing, with Israel and Gaza, is the rapidly changing and volatile region of the world. And it's, people, that's sort of the context that this is occurring in. But you also have a point that's central to your analysis, and that's the point that Israel's attacks on Gaza is part of, it's occurring in a whole set of global conflicts, including, most importantly, the clash between the West, the U.S. and European imperialists, and Islamic fundamentalism, in terms of that's what's actually going on in large parts of the world. And I wanted you to talk about that and how it relates to what you see going on in the region now.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is something that, no one needs to or should be in denial about. I mean, there has been a rise of Islamic fundamentalism in the region, and that it doesn't represent anything good. One thing I wanted to say, just going back to what we were talking about earlier, the fact that forces like Hamas or, Ahmadinejad in Iran and so on use terminology for their own demagogic reasons about Israel not being a legitimate state doesn't mean that it's not true. Those forces aren't good. They are disingenuous when they raise this stuff. But, we can't be, I can't say Israel's not legitimate because that puts me in the camp with those forces. No, it doesn't. Any more than, for example, the U.S. imperialists say that the Taliban oppressed women. Now, when the U.S. went into Afghanistan and imposed a regime, the role of women didn't get any better. But just because the U.S. said it doesn't mean it's not true. So I just wanted to make that point in passing. But more generally, I mean, the situation is complicated, and yet it can't paralyze us from doing the right thing here. And, I was thinking about how to share this in just a brief way on this show, and in the special issue of Revolution at revcom.us/Israel that I've been talking about, there's a reprint of a section of a talk by Bob Avakian called Bringing Forward Another Way, which the title sort of concentrates, the challenge. But I just want to share this. He says, as a matter of general principle and specifically sitting in this imperialist country, we have a particular responsibility to oppose U.S. imperialism, our quote-unquote own ruling class, and what it is doing in the world. But at the same time, that doesn't make these Islamic fundamentalist forces not historically outmoded and not reactionary. It doesn't change the character of their opposition to imperialism and what it leads to in the dynamic that it's part of. The fact that these two historically outmoded, and here I want to kind of emphasize this in response to what you're bringing up, do reinforce each other, even while opposing each other. The fact is that they do reinforce each other, even while opposing each other. And it's very important to understand and struggle with others to understand that if you end up supporting either of these two historically outmoded, you contribute to strengthening both. It's crucial to break out of that dynamic and bring forward another way. So, there's much to analyze in terms of the relationship between all these different things going on in the Middle East. The Iran nuclear issue, the situation between Israel and the Palestinians, and what you raise, the whole kind of global clash between, the West and Islamic fundamentalist jihad. But I think, again, that can't, if you want to break out of that dynamic, you can't line up with either one, including through silent complicity, living here right now when our government, quote unquote, is backing Israel to the hilt.
Mm-hmm. Just to dig in this a little bit more, because, one of the things, look, I was telling you the other day when we were talking, this question comes from many, many people, where even if people who've read that analysis and they think, okay, yes, that's the case, that's true, I can agree with it theoretically, but really, when you're looking at what's going on and the U.S. is rampaging in various areas and the regimes associated with the U.S. are rampaging in various areas, you're looking at this situation, things like what they did in Libya, or you're looking at situations like what's going on in Syria, or perhaps the threat in Iran, and now the question of Israel and Gaza, and people are saying, well, where the hell do you line up? How do you do something that will actually matter in a situation like that?
Well, first of all, you don't do it by aligning with either of these two forces on the field. Neither of them represent anything good. You want an example? I mean, the Muslim Brotherhood, which we don't have time to go into its whole history and how it was, in a certain sense, as well, the whole range of Islamic fundamentalist forces were in a certain sense put in business by the U.S. during the 1980s for their own purposes. But they're in power in Egypt, Egypt right now. They are 100%, despite their rhetoric, complicit in the strangulation of the people of Gaza. Their border with Gaza is sealed as well, and they've collaborated in shutting down the underground, both physically and legally, tunnels that are the main way that people in Gaza have access to the outside world. So, wherever these forces have come to power, Iran or, in any form, they have not brought anything good for anybody, including the liberation of the Palestinian people. And one of the things that we have going for us in this country, as long as you brought it up, is that, there is a movement for revolution, to put a new stage of communist revolution based on Bob Avakian's New Synthesis on the map. And in that context and in relation to it, all kinds of protests, that the more we could get protest on the map here that was framed in the context of bringing forward another way, the more we can start to really change that equation. I mean, the perspective that that you articulated from your friends or the people you run into just doesn't go anywhere.
All right, Alan, on that note, we are going to have to wrap it up, but thank you very much for joining us today.
Okay, and let me once again encourage people to get to revcom.us for resources and analysis on all this.
Absolutely. All right, thanks a lot. Thanks a lot, Alan.
Okay, take care, man.
You too. Bye. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with Alan Goodman, a writer for Revolution Newspaper, and we've been talking about the Israeli assault against Gaza and the powers behind it and all the things that are going on and what we need to do about it now. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking with Dr. Terry Coopers, who is a psychiatrist and expert on the psychological effects of prison conditions, and we're going to be talking about increase in suicides in prison and what's behind it. So stay tuned. Right, welcome back. That is Sounds of Attica from Otis Taylor. All right. On July 20th, Charles Samuels, the Bureau of Prisons director, sent out a memo speaking to the issue of suicide in prisons and specifically in relation to prisoners held in long-term solitary confinement. And he essentially blamed the prisoners for not taking advantage of the help available to them. And my next guest, Dr. Terry Coopers, wrote a response to that, or wrote a piece that was sort of inspired to respond to that, and where he said that solitary confinement pushes many prisoners to suicide. And that's a point that really knocked me in the head when I read it. The system's blaming the prisoners, blaming the victims, and Dr. Coopers is saying, look, you know what? It's a sharp point. Solitary confinement, in fact, itself pushes many prisoners to suicide. So joining us to talk about this is Dr. Terry Coopers. Terry, how are you?
I'm very good. Thank you for having me on the show.
Sure. You don't remember this, but I had you on the show when I first started a long time ago.
We
talked about Pelican Bay, and oddly enough, and sadly enough, we're back talking about situations very similar to what we talked about before, but even more intense. So let's jump into this. What are you talking about there when you say solitary confinement pushes many prisoners to suicide?
Well, it's really the sort of the tip of the iceberg. What we've got is an imprisonment binge in this country. We've got almost 2.5 million people in prison. And they have not been able to build prisons fast enough, and building prisons isn't the solution. But what we get is a lot of crowding. Crowding causes an increase in violence, an increase in psychosis, an increase in suicide. And as a false solution, what I call a historic wrong turn in the 80s, when the prison population was already five times what it had been in the 70s, they started building entire prison units dedicated to solitary confinement, and these became known as supermax prisons in California at Pelican Bay or Corcoran or Tehachapi in Southern California. And so what happens is that people spend 24 hours a day in their cell by themselves with nothing to do. They have no activities. And they have very limited visits. That kind of conditions, considered torture in the international community and by the human rights groups, causes psychiatric symptoms. And one of the most serious, or the one that becomes public the easiest, is when someone actually kills themselves. And we have an epidemic of suicide in the prisons. It's more than twice as frequent as it is in the community. But in any prison system, and this includes California's Department of Corrections, 50% of the actual completed suicides where someone dies occur among the 6 or 7% of the population who are in solitary confinement. So it seems to me that makes it clear that solitary confinement plays a large part in causing suicide. And then we get this memo from the director of the Bureau of Prisons, which is the federal prison system, to all of the inmates telling them not to kill themselves instead of, for instance, dealing with the conditions that cause people to kill themselves.
Just incredible and repulsive. I'll tell you, now, Terry, you once wrote that
just 3 months, giving people a sense of the impact of solitary confinement on prisoners' mental health and the fact that this could roll over into suicide easily, you said that 3 months of solitary confinement can, in fact, mean lasting emotional damage. Let's talk about that a little.
Yes, it's actually very impressive. I'm an expert witness in class action lawsuits, and I give psychiatric testimony both about the mental health damage and about the conditions that cause damage. Solitary confinement, crowding is one such condition which causes psychiatric damage, but solitary confinement definitely causes a long list of symptoms, including anxiety, paranoia, problems thinking, problems with memory. And one of the main symptoms is despair. That what happens is that people in solitary confinement with no one to talk to and nothing meaningful to do just lose all hope for the future. And they think they're just going to be in solitary until they die, and they make the choice that they'd just as rather die now. So they attempt suicide. The mental health care for people who attempt suicide is terrible. They're put in an observation cell, typically, which is just a cell with a transparent side to it so everybody can see them. They're in there naked, and they're left there until essentially they cry uncle and say, I'm not suicidal anymore, take me back to my cell. Then they're taken back to their cell, and unfortunately, a large number of them do kill themselves.
You know, you just have to ask that question about what kind of system is this that would rely on this barbaric torture as their means of rehabilitation. Clearly, it's not rehabilitation. And actually, one of the things that you said in an article I read that you wrote a couple years ago, you said that this, just continuing along this line, you said that this solitary actually breaks prisoners down and practically guarantees that they will never function normally in society again. That's a pretty heavy statement.
Well, and it's true. I mean, watch any of the rates that we measure. The recidivism rate, when people get out of prison, they're most likely to go back, do a crime, and go back to prison. Or the parole violation rate. Both of those rates have been climbing precipitously in California over recent decades. And in the same period of time, what we've done is turned away from rehabilitation, even though the California Department of Corrections is called Corrections and Rehabilitation, very little rehabilitation goes on. And the supermax prison sort of typifies the anti-rehabilitation concentration. It's just punishment. The worse and worse punishments, the more that people break down under the awful conditions. So a large proportion of the prisoners, 6 to 8% of prisoners are in solitary right now. But actually, most prisoners rotate through solitary, and they'll do months or years in solitary sometime in their prison term. And then that makes them less capable of functioning either in a program inside prison, like a rehabilitation program, if they're lucky enough to find one, and in the community when they get out. So that basically what's happening is our system is breaking people so that they'll never function again. This is especially the case with people with mental illness, which society has been kind of shunting into prisons for decades.
I want to talk to you about that specifically in a minute, but let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dr. Terry Coopers, psychiatrist and expert on the psychological effects of prison conditions, including, most importantly in this conversation, solitary confinement. And we're talking about that and the increase in suicide related to solitary confinement. Now, Terry, one of the things you make a point in another article, you make a point about the direct connection between the increase in mentally ill people in prison and jails, and the fact that there's more mentally ill people in prison and jails than in psychiatric hospitals today, and you talk about the relationship between that and solitary and suicide. Let's talk about that a little bit. The system creates madness in prison and exacerbates madness that already exists.
You know, Michael, we have been disappearing people with mental illness. What's going on in the community, if you look around, there's very little in the way of public mental health services. In the 60s, with President Kennedy, we had the Community Mental Health Centers Act, and there were public clinics where people who didn't have a lot of affluence could go and get treatment for their serious mental illness. Over the decades since that time, the funding for public mental health, like all social safety net programs, has been diminishing, as has support for housing, low-income housing, and such. And what that's done is left people with serious mental illness who tend to be the lowest income bracket. It's left them without services, without a place to live. A lot of them become homeless. And then for one reason or another, sometimes laws the city makes against panhandling or something, they get thrown into jail and then eventually find their way into prison. So what society has done is disappeared the population of people, those with low income who are suffering from serious mental illness, inside the prisons. And then the attitude is lock them up and throw away the key. No one really pays attention to what happens to them in there. And I think people conveniently think, well, probably they're getting mental health care in prison. Well, they're not. The budget for mental health care in prison is as bad or worse than it is in the community, proportionately. And so they're getting very little care, and selectively, they get thrown in solitary confinement because they don't quite know how to behave in such a way to get on the good side of the guards. The guards don't know what to do with them because they're a little unusual and sometimes bizarre. So the guards end up punishing them, which is all they know how to do. They put them in solitary confinement. And in solitary confinement, there's very good research about this, or very frightening research, that their mental illness gets worse and they're more prone to suicide.
Just amazing. I keep saying that because the more you talk, the more I uncovered in reading your material, the more just so terribly upset people. People need to investigate this and actually start giving a damn about what the hell is happening behind these prison walls. You know, and one of the things, Terry, you talked about, and this really struck me because the movie Snake Pit always stuck in my mind, and it seemed to be a point where people's social consciousness began to develop, or at least develop some consciousness of the horrors that were going on in supposed mental health hospitals. You talk about the conditions that prisoners are facing, mentally ill prisoners are facing in jail now, is actually worse than the kind of situation that was described in that movie Snake Pit.
Well, yes, we've actually reproduced the conditions the Snake Pit was about. Irving Goffman was a sociologist of deviance in the 50s and 60s, and wrote a book called Asylum, which a lot of us sort of grew up on. In that book, he describes a young man who is taken by his parents to a hospital because they think that he's crazy. He complains he's not crazy, and he gets louder and louder protesting that he's sane. They take him to the emergency room, and a psychiatrist hears him protesting and says, well, you're absolutely right. He must be crazy to be protesting so loud, and locks him up in the hospital. The kid then gets increasingly inappropriate and angry and throws a chair through a window, and they lock him up in a little solitary seclusion room. And in that and they take away his clothes and all writing materials. And in that seclusion room, he starts smearing feces on the wall. And what Goffman says is that if you look at that, we are progressively taking away every human method of communicating from this young man. We're not listening to his protest, and he's becoming more and more extreme in his attempts to communicate. Well, that's exactly what's going on in the prisons today. And in these solitary confinement units, we have prisoners, grown men, smearing feces on the wall. And they're naked, they have nothing in the cell with them, and they're left there for months alone. And the staff then say, well, they're manipulating to get out of solitary. They're being driven crazy by the conditions.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dr. Terry Coopers, psychiatrist and expert on the psychological effects of prison conditions, including, most importantly, solitary confinement. And we're talking about that and the increase in suicide related to solitary confinement. You know, Terry, we have time for one more question. That's an important one, because the excuse that's always given to the public in general is that, look, you don't understand. We are dealing with the worst of the worst. You want us to stop solitary confinement? This is simply punishment. This is simply behavior control. This is simply preventing the worst of the worst from unleashing massive amounts of violence in the prisons. What do you say to that?
Well, we should have a longer discussion about that. It's absolutely false, and research is showing that. I was involved in a class action lawsuit the ACLU brought in Mississippi, where there was a supermax prison at Parchman, Mississippi State Penitentiary, 1,000 cells of solitary confinement. And in the course of the lawsuit, the Department of Corrections in Mississippi agreed with the ACLU and our experts that they had too many people locked up in solitary, and they agreed to let them go. So they let 800 prisoners of the 1,000 that were in solitary confinement, released them into the general population. Now, according to the logic that you just put forward, that is that solitary confinement is necessary because they take care of the worst, one would think that if you release them out of solitary, the violence rate would go up, not just in that prison, but elsewhere in the system. In fact, the violence rate went way down precipitously when they released those individuals from solitary in the entire prison system, and the individuals who were released received very few disciplinary infractions. That's just one piece of evidence. There are many disproving the idea that this decreases violence. It actually increases violence, and not only at the time that people are put in solitary, but afterwards, because eventually you have to let them out. And say a person has an 8-year sentence to prison. If they spend the entire 8 years in solitary, at the end of the 8 years, they're supposed to be released because the court only sentenced them to 8 years. Now they're coming out of prison having had no social interactions, just angry exchanges with guards, and absolutely no meaningful activities for 8 years. How well are they going to do out in the community, and how safe is the community going to be?
Exactly. And, you know, I kept thinking about this, and I'm really glad, that you did. I read your piece on Mississippi, and I thought that was extremely important, and that was one of the reasons I wanted to get into this question. And I kept thinking, too, here we're talking about the prisoners unleashing violence. I mean, if you think in California, remember the way that they set up the gladiator bouts between prisoners and the intense violence that's unleashed on the prisoners by the guards themselves, and including, the setting up things where people were actually encouraged to kill each other, for sport. To me, this is a kind of thing when you talk about that, and then you talked about, and I want to have, I lied, I guess. I have one more quick question. You kept mentioning that mental health doesn't exist in prison. What is the state? Let's just give people, we've talked about all these horrors. What is the state of mental health care available to prisoners today?
Well, there's a fallacy in public thinking about this, and that is that we think we have mental health services in prison that we don't have in the community. The truth is the mental health item in the corrections budget. Corrections budgets tend to stay flat. That is, while everything else, including education and roads, is being cut, the budget for corrections in the state budget process tends to stay flat. But actually, what's happening is that the guard salaries and the administrator salaries are going up and the construction costs are going up. But if you check the item for mental health services within the corrections budget, it keeps going down approximately like it does in the community. So there's less and less mental health services. And what you get in solitary frequently is a psychiatrist who's working very few hours. He's got hundreds of patients who are in a cell by themselves. He walks around to the front of the cell and says to the prisoner, "How are you doing? Are you hearing voices? Are you still feeling suicidal?" In prison, there's a huge stigma about being weak or having a mental illness. So the prisoner is not going to admit to a psychiatrist standing at his cell door, "Yes, I'm hearing voices." So he's just going to nod him away. He's going to say, "Go away, I'm fine." And so what happens is the prisoner essentially gets no care. The psychiatrist is coming to see if he needs to change his medication. The prisoner is refusing to talk to him because he'll be badly stigmatized and probably beaten or killed by other prisoners because he has a mental illness. And so nothing happens in the way of mental health care, and that's approximately average.
All right, Terry, we have to wrap this up, but I'm going to have you back again sometime in the near future because we do have to continue this conversation. It's one
Great.
Of the most pressing questions in society
Great
today.
Great to talk to you.
You too, Terry. Thanks a lot. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Dr. Terry Coopers. Dr. Coopers is a psychiatrist and expert on the psychological effects of prison conditions, and in particular, the increase in suicides among prisoners subjected to solitary confinement in the so-called supermax prisons. So we're going to take a quick, or actually, no, you know what I want to do? I want to mention this right now. And this is extremely important in relation to prisoners and what they've been doing. And people are aware of the prison hunger strike that went on in California and was supported by prisoners and other people, many other people, thousands of people across the country, although many thousands more need to support what the prisoners are doing. Well, on October 10th of this year, California prisoners issued a call for peace between different nationalities in prisons and jails, an extremely important document, an extremely important call. And you can go to revcom.us and look at that call, read it, think about it, think about what they're saying about the importance of the struggle there and the importance, the significance of these people who are pitted against each other in society and in the prisons themselves, standing up and calling for unity between different nationalities in all the prisons and jails. So you get that, you go read that, you figure out what you can do with it, you send it to your friends, send it to your relatives, send it to people in prison and outside of prison, and let your voice be heard. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking with Gregory Koger, and we're going to be talking with him about what happened to him 3 years ago and what's happening to him now for attempting to videotape a statement against censorship in Chicago. Yeah.
All right, Baby Huey with Listen to Me. All right, hear what I say. 3 years ago, Gregory Koger, our next guest, was arrested for attempting to document a political statement opposing censorship that was being made by Sansara Taylor in response to the Ethical Humanist Society of Chicago rescinding a longstanding invitation she had to speak at that society on the basis of her political beliefs. Gregory was assaulted and beaten by the police, arrested and charged, did 2 months in prison, and after a 3-year political and legal battle, he has been convicted and has been sentenced to 300 days in jail. And the fight still goes on. And joining us to talk about all this is Gregory Koger. Gregory, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you, Michael. I'm glad that you have me on. I have an opportunity to speak with you and everybody who's listening.
Right, good. Well, let's jump into it. What the hell is going on here, Gregory?
Well, you know, it's a very complex case on a number of different levels. And just for kind of the basic facts, as you stated, Sansara Taylor, who's a writer for Revolution Newspaper, who is probably a fairly frequent guest on your show, I know she's been on there a number of times, was invited to speak at the Ethical Humanist Society by a now former board member. And 2 weeks or so before her scheduled talk was supposed to go down, you know, some forces behind the scenes in the Ethical Humanist Society basically got wind that she was a communist, which is not a secret of anybody who knows who Sansara Taylor is. And essentially, they got her disinvited from speaking there on November 1st on a talk that she was supposed to do on morality without God, essentially an atheist morality. And a number of people spoke out about that, people that she had spoken on panels with publicly, and they were unable to essentially get them to rescind their disinvitation to her. She had a workshop on women's liberation and the emancipation of all humanity on the Saturday, which was October 31st, which went down without incident. I was there videotaping the entire thing, working with board members and other people of the Ethical Humanist Society. And, you know, she made a statement at that time stating, you know, look, it was wrong for you to disinvite me, especially as it was based on, you know, complete distortions of what her positions were, and that she would come there the next day to allow people, you know, to hear the reasoning why she was actually disinvited and invite people to come and hear her talk at an off-site location. That was actually at a home of someone who's now a former member of the Ethical Humanist Society. So we then came there the next morning. I was videotaping the entire time. And essentially, as she was giving her brief statement, I was holding an iPhone, and the police came up, dragged me out, f***ed me up. Oh, excuse me. I have to watch my language. And, you know, essentially, after a very long political prosecution, they convicted me and sends me to 300 days in jail. That's the short version of the story.
Yeah, and let's talk about this. They convicted you. What were the charges that you faced?
Well, they charged me with criminal trespassing, under which they alleged that I was told that I could not videotape and that I videotaped anyways, which is not what trespassing is. It has a very specific legal criteria. Telling somebody not to do something is not one of those criteria. They then charged me with resisting arrest and battery to a police officer, in which the undercover police officer who was waiting there, hired by the Ethical Humanist Society, alleged that when he informed me that I was under arrest for criminal trespassing, which never happened, that I stopped and pushed him in the chest 1 inch. Again, that didn't happen either. But those were the three charges that I was charged with: criminal trespassing under a completely novel reinterpretation of what trespassing is, resisting arrest, and battery, which is technically the lowest form of battery, which is contact of an insulting or provoking nature. None of these are even considered violent crimes. They're all misdemeanors.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Gregory Koger. Gregory's a former prisoner and activist, and he's facing 300 days in jail for filming a statement against censorship, doing actually, in that situation, the only ethical thing one could do, and which is kind of ironic in relation to the unethical stuff that was going on at that Ethical Humanist Society meeting or whatever it was. So, Gregory, tell me this. There was the push to convict you and to get you sent off to jail.
there were a lot of irregularities in the trial that actually illustrate the politics behind the whole case and the nature of the justice system and society we live in. Can you tell our listeners some of what these irregularities actually were? Because to me, it's kind of shocking to anybody who thinks like, well, there's just this rote, you go through court, whatever, and they may do, you know, they may frame you or do whatever, or boost up the charges for something that you didn't do. But actually, this was a well-considered, very, very, very carefully orchestrated court case that sort of turned around, changed in the middle, and did all kinds of things. There were irregularities that one normally doesn't even see in the movies.
Yeah, sure. Well, I can, you know, I mean, first of all, as you alluded to, you know, and I heard a brief segment of your previous guest. Look, I went to prison when I was 17 years old. I spent over 6 years straight in solitary confinement. I became a revolutionary and started to, you know, take up understanding the world while I was in prison, you know, through primarily the work of the Prisoners Revolutionary Literature Fund, which sent me revolutionary literature. And, you know, since I've been released approximately 6 years ago, my life has been dedicated to, you know, fighting for a radically different future for humanity, a communist world. And so that was, in fact, what the whole reason why I was there videotaping Sansara Taylor. And that is kind of the backdrop of what this case is really about. So I'll give you an example of one of the most probably outrageous examples of irregularity was, you know, as after I was charged, my defense committee organized a number of public events to speak about some of the broader issues that are kind of encapsulated in this case and concentrated in this case. You know, we had discussions with people like Bill Ayers and Cindy Sheehan, and we had a film screening of a movie called Disturbing the Universe, which is about a radical attorney, William Kunstler, with one of his daughters, who's a filmmaker and a labor attorney, and me and several other people that we spoke at Northwestern University. And the next court hearing that we had after that film screening, you know, it's a routine, basically, status hearing. When we're basically getting ready to end the hearing, the prosecutor comes up and says that they're bringing a contempt of court motion against me for my defense committee having a website discussing my case in a political context and, you know, printouts of everything from the website that was entirely political. So that was kind of one of the most overt examples of, you know, direct political nature of this case. The other things, you know, when before we went to the trial, you know, we had tried to, you know, question the jury about their, you know, views on communism, you know, and basically the backstory of what this entire case was about. And the judge completely ruled out any political questioning around people's, you know, prejudices or predetermined ideas about communism or any other political things. And you tried to completely deny and bar from the trial anything related to the political nature of this. And in the appellate court's decision, literally in the second paragraph, you know, it describes Sansara Taylor as, quote, a self-avowed communist, which never occurred in the trial and, you know, is not a fact that was in the record. I mean, of course, she's a communist, but that never even occurred in the trial because they specifically barred that from happening. And I guess probably another most recent example of that is when the Illinois Supreme Court refused to hear my appeal, essentially, at the end of September. And basically 2 days later, the state's attorney filed a motion essentially for them to put me back into jail immediately to revoke the appeal bond that I've been on. And in that motion, they bring up this completely irrelevant but highly political, and, you know, it has nothing to do with revoking my bond, that I had once asked the court for permission to travel out of state for matters related to Prisoners Revolutionary Literature Fund.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Gregory Koger. Gregory's a former prisoner and activist, and he's facing 300 days in jail for filming a statement against censorship. You know, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, and since you're headed in that direction, you know, there's a whole point here of you being a revolutionary communist, you being a revolutionary activist, and someone who had this particular experience. I want you to talk about this a little bit, the particular experience of being in jail for 11 years, doing so long in solitary, and actually the transformation that you underwent. And now you actually, I know one of the things that you are really sits in your heart deep is the Prisoners Revolutionary Literature Fund. And I wanted you to talk about that because you have said that you view your case as being very much linked up to the slow genocide of mass incarceration and the question of prisoners and transformation and the fact that prisoners can transform into a very needed revolutionary force in society. Can you talk about that and your own experience in doing that?
Sure, yeah. You know, I mean, I actually was thinking about this. You know, there's a statement from Bob Avakian in his book Basics. It's actually from the third chapter, you know, and it's the 17th quote in there, and it's basically that people say, you mean to tell me that these youth running around selling drugs and killing each other and caught up in all kinds of other stuff can be the backbone of this revolutionary state power in the future? Yes, but not as they are now and not without struggle. They weren't always selling drugs and killing each other and the rest of it, and they don't have to be into all of that in the future. Ask yourself, how does it happen that you go from beautiful children to supposedly irredeemable monsters in a few years? It's because of the system and what it does to people, not because of the unchanging and unchangeable human nature. And, you know, I heard you also allude to, you know, this statement that came out from some of the leaders of the California prison hunger strike, you know, that they really have stepped up some unity against the conditions that they're facing. In any case, so that's just the backdrop. Look, you know, I was somebody who was in a street gang. I went to prison for shooting somebody else in another gang. You know what I'm saying? I was totally in that life. And, you know, had I not went to prison, I probably would have been dead by the time I was 18 years old. And that was what this system had for me. And, you know, solitary confinement is an extremely difficult experience. I mean, I know brothers who are my age that I've had as rational conversations as you and I have had, who after several months in solitary confinement completely lost their minds. You know what I'm saying? And some of them are probably still sitting there right now today. But one thing that many people do have the opportunity to do when they are in those conditions is to reflect and to think, and especially if they get revolutionary literature, and they get literature that actually opens their eyes to the reality of what brought them to be in that situation and actually posits a strategy for how that the world could be radically different, you know what I'm saying? It's extremely important because, you know, going back to the bigger picture, as you were saying, look, you know, part of, as Carl Dix talked about, you know, part of the reason why we have mass incarceration is because the people who rule this system recognize the potential of the youth, in particular black youth and people from oppressed communities in the 1960s. And so mass incarceration was a part of their counter strategy, you know, kind of a counter insurgency before the insurgency to shut down that revolutionary potential. And so getting this literature into those people who this system literally has no future for is extremely important. And I am one example of that, you know.
Well, let me ask you this, Gregory. You know, how did this happen with you? Because you talked about prisoners having the chance to reflect and to think about the bigger questions in society. But there has to be a connection made between revolutionary analysis and the prisoners themselves and their access to this. How did this transformation happen with you?
Well, you know, I mean, that's a long question. But if I could attempt to approach it. You know, I mean, I guess, you know, I mean, look, you come into that situation, and there's actually, I think, in the main, there is somewhat of a broad sense among people who are in prison that they do want to understand things. They do want to, you know, figure out, you know, why are they there? What is happening in the world? You know, and these are mainly people who this society says really shouldn't be thinking about that. They can't think about that. They shouldn't know about that. You know, but there's a kind of a broad desire, I think, about among many people who find themselves in prison to understand those things. I mean, for me personally, you know, look, I literally went to a fundamentalist Baptist Christian school from the age of 3 to about 15. So one of the first things that I really had to confront and eventually break with was this religious indoctrination that I had. You know, and I came out of that after studying many different religions and philosophies and atheists. And, you know, I guess from a more direct political side of it, you know, it struck me as someone in that situation, you know, as I began to confront the political reality of it that, okay, the state is holding me here. Okay, F the state, I'm going to be an anarchist, you know, and that went from being, you know, just kind of that simple, visceral realization to actually studying some of the theoretical foundational thinkers of anarchism from Proudhon, and Kropotkin, Bakunin, you know, all of that. But then, you know, once I was getting close to getting out of prison, I really was thinking, okay, how would we actually change society, and wanting to be involved with a grouping of people who was actually doing that. And I ran up against a number of what I felt were limitations to anarchism, and I felt that especially, you know, what was put forward in Revolution Newspaper and Bob Avakian's New Synthesis, that it actually had an answer to that. So I don't know if that exactly answers your question in a broad sense. But
yeah, that's good. And we have about one more minute where I wanted to ask you, where can people find out what is going on with your case? Where can they find out more information about this and what they can do?
Yes, well, my defense committee's website is dropthecharges.net. We do have a public statement that we're asking people to sign on to, which is essentially, we say not one more day in jail. We support Gregory Koger and oppose his wrongful conviction. The court will set a date very soon. We will go into that and oppose them putting me back in jail. Whether they allow us to make that argument in the court, we'll have a demonstration and rally outside the court if they do put me in jail. And if they do put me in jail, look, I will continue to be doing what I'm doing. It strikes me as a little stupid for them to put somebody like me back in the middle of 10,000 prisoners in the Cook County Jail to organize them. But if that's what they're going to do, that's what they're going to do. And, you know, I hope people will check it out. If there's prisoners listening, you know, much love to you guys. And thank you for having me on, Michael.
All right, Gregory, thank you very much, and we'll talk to you again soon. Take care now, man.
Thanks.
Okay,
bye
now.
Bye.
All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. And we've just been talking with Gregory Koger, former prisoner and revolutionary activist who's facing 300 days in jail for video recording a statement against censorship. I want to thank all of my guests today, Alan Goodman, Dr. Terry Coopers, and Gregory Koger. And I want to thank all of you for tuning in. You want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And remember one thing, if you take nothing else away from this show, the world is crying out for revolution like never before. And you have to measure up where you're going to stand in relation to that and how you're going to answer the crying needs of humanity. Now, we're going to go out now with Numbered Days from Ross Michael. So check it out.